Welcome to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, your source for learning more about fly fishing in cold water, warm water, and salt water. Hello, I'm Roger Maves, your host for Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio. On this broadcast, we'll be featuring John Barr, and he'll be answering your most important questions on tying flies and fishing them. This show will be 90 minutes in length, and we are going to be broadcasting live over the Internet. If you'd like to ask John a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use that Q&A text box in the middle of the page there to send us your question. We'll receive your questions immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them on the show as possible tonight. This broadcast is being recorded and will be available for playback on our website within 24 hours after the show ends. If you have to leave early, you can return to our website at your convenience and listen to the broadcast at any time. Content of this broadcast is copyrighted and is the property of the Knowledge Group, Inc., doing business as Ask About Fly Fishing. Recordings or transcriptions of this show cannot be distributed or sold in any form. When we return, we'll be talking with John Barr about fly tying and fishing those flies. Get ready to visit International Sportsman's Exposition near you. Northern California, Denver, Phoenix, or Salt Lake City. Each ISE spotlights 400 to 600 plus exhibitors, including fly shops and hundreds of lodges, guides, and outfitters from across the West, Canada, Alaska, and even South America. Watch ISE's Best of the West Distance Casting Contest. Learn from the best local fly tiers at our How-To Center and Fly Tying Video Theater. Meet fly fishing legends and next generation stars at ISE's Fly Fishing Theater. Clouser, Dennis, Rickards, Blanton, O'Keefe, Gunn, Patine, Dorsey, dozens more. Watch film premieres of Soulfish by Mikey Weir and Equilibrium by Dr. Grant Wiswell. Schedules and info online right now at sportsexpos.com. That's www.sportsexpos.com. Well, before we introduce John, we'd like to let you know about some of the great gifts we have to give away tonight. On our drawing tonight, we'll be giving away a 3-year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers and also a 1-year subscription to Fly Fusion magazine. Now, if you haven't registered yet, just go to our homepage, and right below John's section, you should find a link there that says register for the drawing. And just click on that link, fill out the form, and we'll be drawing from those people at the end of the show. We'll also be giving away John's book, Barr Flies, and this just came out this fall, and this is provided by Stackpole Books and John Barr. And here's how you're going to win that. You have to listen closely tonight on the show. And at the end of the show, we're going to ask a question about something that John discusses and tells us on the show. And if you have the right answer, then you can win the book. Now, to do that, you'll fill out that form on our homepage where you submit questions. And on that form, just put in your answer and your name and your location. Got to put your name and your location to win. And the first one that comes in will be, that's the correct answer, will win that book. John started his fly tying journey in a garage many years ago when he was only 5 or 6 years old. He learned to tie flies from his next door neighbor, as many of us have, and in that afternoon started a lifelong affair with tying flies and fishing them. Much of his early years fishing were spent in San Jose, California, fly fishing for crappies and bluegills in the local gravel pits. And as he branched out developing his skills, he started fishing for trout in the Merced River, Yosemite National Park, and streams and lakes throughout the Sierras. His favorite patterns at the time were a brown bivisible, a hairwing western coachman, and a western bucktail. Well, today, most of the flies John Barr fishes and ties are patterns representing aquatic insects, since they provide a significant part of the diet for trout. His own designs include well-known patterns, such as the Copper John, Barr Emerger, Visit Dunn, Graphic Caddis, and the Meat Whistle. These and many of his other patterns are contained in his book, Barr Flies. John recently worked with Landon Mayer in the production of a DVD, Landing the Trout of Your Life, and is finishing work on a soon-to-be-released DVD of his own on fly fishing for bass, titled Weapons of Bass Production. John Barr is a fly designer for Umpqua Feather Merchants, and on the advisory staff for Sage, Sims, Rio, and Outcast, and is a member of the Ross Pro Staff. John, welcome to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio.
Well, Roger, I tell you, it's a pleasure to be your guest, and I'm happy to be here.
Good. Okay, tonight, folks, we've got a lot to cover as usual, probably more than what we can handle, but we'll give it a shot, as always. We're going to talk about tying a few of John's flies, the Copper John, of course. We're going to look at the Visidun and hopefully the Slump Buster, three different, totally different kinds of flies. He's going to walk us through some of those flies and tying those flies, and we're going to answer a lot of the questions that you've sent in that are just kind of random, talking about emergers or midges or fly fishing techniques and so forth. We just got you guys really put out on the questions this week, and we appreciate that. We love those questions come in. And we'll try to get to them, as many of them as we can. And like I said, don't hesitate to submit one online as you're listening, and we'll try to address those as well. Let's start out, John, then, with none other than Copper John.
Okay.
How'd this fly come about in the first place? Give us a little history and how you developed it.
Okay, I'll tell you, Roger. Back in the early 90s, I was floating to Colorado with Jackson Strait, owner of Mountain Anglers, fly shop guide service. And we eddied out, and we were fishing this really nice, productive-looking run. And we spread out, and I was fishing a straight hopper. And Jackson, I thought, was fishing a straight hopper as well. But then he catches his fish, and it's dangling below the hopper when he lands it. And I go, Jackson, what are you doing? And he showed me he was fishing a hopper with a nymph dropper under the hopper. I'd never fished that way before. And that was, as I say, back in the early 90s. And so from there, a light bulb went off, and I said, I need a fly that's just going to plummet off that hopper. And that's when the Copper John started its origin. And I spent 3 years using different hooks, different materials, whatnot. And after about 3 years, the final product, as we see it today, arrived. And my plan was to use it as a fly that would sink very rapidly and attract fish, but I didn't know if it catch fish. And then hang a more realistic pattern, a pupa or an emerger, whatever, off the bend of the copper. So it turned out the copper caught a whole bunch of fish, and, you could bait and switch them to the more realistic pattern, and it's become an integral part of my fishing since the mid-90s, after the final product was completed.
Yeah, yeah. What did you start out? I mean, what did the fly really start out as? I mean, the first Copper John, what was it composed of compared to what it is today?
Okay, I started off with a partridge for a tail, copper wire for the abdomen, no taper, no lead. I used turkey quill for the wing case, no flash over the turkey quill, and partridge for the legs. And it worked. It caught fish. Then partridge was a little fragile, and I was losing the tail pretty fast and the legs pretty fast. So I went to Hemback for the legs and Biots for the tail, and I put lead behind the bead to make it even heavier, and Thin Skin, which is an awesome product for wing cases, instead of the turkey quill. And it just made it a lot cleaner, and the turkey quill, to make it real clean, you had to put, two or three coats of epoxy on it to make it real, look real good. So, with the advent of new materials, flies, change. So that's kind of where we ended up, is what we have now.
And before we talk any more about the Copper John, I want you to know that if you go to the homepage and right in John's section there where it says more about John Barr, if you click on that and go to his speakers page, you'll see a picture of the Copper John that he's talking about. And if you go further down the page, you'll see the three flies that we're going to try to cover tonight, Copper John, Visidun, and Slump Buster. And to the right is a link to the fly recipe for that fly. This will take you to Charlie Craven's, Charlie's Fly Box website, who was the photographer and helped John put the book together that he has, and had done this exquisite photography. That will take you to the recipes on his site so you can kind of follow along if you don't have John's book and kind of reference those photographs as we talk about it. So hopefully that'll help everybody out. Now, let's do just that, John. Let's kind of walk our way through that fly, and maybe give people, you know, you mentioned a few of the things that were involved in it, but let's talk about today. What are the materials that you need to create this fly?
Okay, from the top, for the tail, you need goose biots. For the underbody, you need UTC 70 denier thread. It lays in nice flat where you build up a nice taper for the underbody. You need ultra wire in various colors. You need thin skin for the wing case. And I'm going to strip a flashaboo. It can be various colors. I like Mirage Opal. And then you need henback for the legs and peacock for the thorax. And a beak, tungsten or brass. I prefer tungsten.
Okay, that's our material list there. Now, working our way through the fly, how do you start out? I mean, what's your? I noticed you use a certain technique with the lead there right at the beginning.
Okay, yeah, a real critical part of constructing this fly is you put the bead on, and you want to have a nice radius rear part of the bead, and then I'll wrap 13 wraps of lead behind the bead and shove it up into the bead, and that really locks the bead in. And then you put your biots on for the tail, and a really critical part is to make it really look good is to use this UTC thread, which lays flat and 70 denier, and you wrap over the biots all the way up to the lead and build up a nice tapered underbody, which is real flat, and that allows you to lay in the wire so that the wire is real clean and spaced real evenly.
So that's how you build your underbody paper there?
That's the real critical part that a lot of people don't do.
Yeah, great, that taper. Okay.
Yeah.
Now, what kind of hook sizes do you usually, what are your favorite sizes for this fly?
First of all, as I said earlier, I used a lot of different hooks, and I ended up with a TMC 5262, which is a 2-extra-long, 2-extra-strong hook, and that just made the proportions come out really nice. The majority of the coppers that I use are 14s, 16s, and 18s. Then I use some 20s, 22s, and some 12s. But the majority are 14s and 16s.
Okay. I just had a question come in on the Internet, and I'm not sure that it's didn't come in before I mentioned where you could see these tied. But again, folks, if you're looking to see pictures of these and the recipes, go to John's speakers page, which you can reach from our homepage, where it says More About John bar, and then go to that, scroll down, and you'll see the Copper John and to the right fly recipe. Click on that. That will take you to Charlie Craven's site, and the full recipe and photographs are there. So in case anybody missed that came in late, that's where you can see what's happening there.
Okay.
Okay, so that takes us through about step 13, and then you tie in the wire at that point then, right?
Yeah, I tie the wire in right behind the lead. Again, this allows you to get a nice even taper, and then I wrap down the wire to the where the biots are tied in, and then I wrap back up and then just tie the wire. And kind of a key little point on getting nice tight wraps on the wire is to kind of do it really, kind of hold it really tight and kind of put a little rearward pressure on the wire, and that'll allow you to get a real nice, clean abdomen.
Okay, and then next step is?
Tie off the wire, right there at the back of the lead.
Right.
Okay, the next step, you tie in your flash, a single strand. It can be pearl, it can be, I like Opal Mirage, but it's not real important, but just a single strand of flash. Next step, tie in your thin skin. Next step, tie in your peacock curl. And then you wrap your peacock curl for the thorax. Then you wrap in your legs right behind the bead, just on each side. And then you pull the thin skin over your peacock and your legs. And then you pull a flash over the thin skin, tie it off, and done deal.
That's it, huh?
Hmm?
Well, it looks great. And you always use the black thin skin, no matter what color you're tying?
I use black thin skin for every single color. The final step is to epoxy over the wing case.
Okay. A single coat, or?
Just single coat, yeah.
Okay.
One coat.
All right. Good. Now, you've tied this. The original one was copper, of course, for Copper John, right?
That was a natural copper.
Natural copper. Okay. John French in Southern California wants to know, have you noticed any preferable colors to tie the Copper John with, favorite fish colors? And he says, thanks for the great patterns. So can you talk about, I know in your book here you have a whole bunch of different colors you tie. Any favorites you have there?
Well, I'll tell you, I mean, the original copper is still good. When I first started tying this wide ultra wire, which Wopsy introduced, a lifetime material company in Arkansas, came out with just a tremendous array of colors. But anyway, I originally tied it in copper, and then I tied a red and a green. Those wires were available before ultra wire. Then it just kind of went from there. It's just kind of fun tying all these different colors. But as far as colors go, you can't go wrong with the original copper. But one total lock is if there's PMD activity, which often accompanies yellow Sally activity, a size 16 red with a flashback bar merger PMD dropper off the bend is total money. I mean, and I've fished that in so many different rivers, and it's worked, you know, really well in a number of different locations. So
copper is the all-around probably favorite, you're saying, right?
Yeah, it is. I mean, you just can't go wrong.
And then during a pale morning dun hatch, you like to switch over to a red, right?
Yeah, pale morning dun, yellow cell activity, I mean, 16 red.
Okay. So John Margeroni in San Mateo asked, what's the one color? And so we just answered that for you, John. It's probably still the copper is the favorite.
I'd say red and copper are tied.
Are tied, okay.
So number one.
And if you could, I've got a question here from David Gower in Kentucky. Your Copper John works great in winter in all black when small black stoneflies are present. You might not know this, John. In 3 feet deep trout spring creeks, should the Copper John be bumping the bottom 6 inches above it or higher off the bottom? So he's actually asking about fishing techniques here. You know, it sounds like it's working good for him, but he's wanting to know, should he be bumping it on the bottom, which is not the way that you had just talked about fishing it, right?
Well, I'll tell you, you know, I mean, people, you know, trout aren't just Velcro to the bottom when they're not rising. I mean, they suspend in the water column, and they will also come up from the bottom to take a fly. So, where your fly is positioned, I mean, they can work anywhere in the water column. Generally, in the winter, you definitely want to have your flies closer to the bottom because that's usually where the fish are hanging out, you know. But it's not there's no rule on exactly what depth, you know, the fish will fly.
So even though that you originally kind of designed it as a mid. Oh, well, you said you dropped it off a hopper, and then you hung a fly below that, so you had a hopper-copper-dropper combination. And so you really didn't design it as a bottom type of fly to fish on the bottom originally, but no reason why it can't be.
Of course not. I mean, it just depends on the water depth.
Sure.
You know, I mean, you may be fishing 2 feet one cast, 3 feet the next cast, 4 feet the next cast. And so, I mean, it's not an exact science, exactly how deep you fish the fly, unless you stay in one run that's exactly the same depth, which never happens.
John, we need to take a little break here, so have a drink of water, and I'll be right back in about 30 seconds, okay?
Sounds good.
It's the AFTA Consumer Fly Fishing Show, January 4th, 5th, and 6th at the Colorado Convention Center. Pre-register at www.theflyfishingexpo.com and save 20%. Don't miss the best fly fishing show of the year. Come see the latest and greatest rods, reels, fly lines, waders, gear, flies, new clothing for 2008, and great seminars on fly fishing by industry experts. Over 100 manufacturers. Meet the USA fly fishing team and collect autographs. Boy Scouts, Girl Scouts, and kids under 10 years old get in free when they're accompanied by an adult. So visit www.theflyfishingexpo.com to pre-register today and save 20%. Well, you're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio. We're talking with John Barr about tying and fishing his great patterns. If you'd like to ask John a question, just go to our homepage, put your question in that Q&A text box, and send it over to us. We'll receive it. We'll try to answer as many of them as we can on the show tonight. Well, we just got a comment in here, John, from Rod Brashears in Amarillo, and he said, I'd like to thank you for the many flies that you've created. The Copper John and the Slump Buster has saved the day on many trips. Out of all the flies that you have created, what is your favorite?
Well, first of all, I appreciate the kind words. Oh, man, that's like asking who's your favorite kid. You know, my favorite fly is, it depends on where you're at and what you're doing and whatnot. I don't have one favorite fly.
Okay.
But the flies he mentioned are definitely some of my favorites, right at the top of the list.
Sure. Okay. Let's see what else we've got here. Tim in Connecticut, what are the techniques most popular to fish the Copper John?
Well, I'll tell you, I mean, you can do, just fish it under an indicator. That works. Starting late spring through fall, if there aren't rising fish, I'm usually fishing a hopper with a copper dropper in appropriate water. It's a lethal pattern in still waters. It's caught just a number of species beyond trout. It's caught lots of brim, bass. I was fishing this pond this last summer, and the guy got a 22-pound channel cat on a size 16 green copper, fishing for brim.
So it catches anything.
A friend of mine caught a bonefish on one.
Oh, my gosh.
So I think it's just kind of one of those deals you can't explain. I'm a results-oriented guy.
Right.
Don't overanalyze things. But it's an effective fly.
Well, one of the things that you've got in your book, and of course you're kind of well-known for, is that hopper, copper, and then the dropper. And that's three-fly rig, which is, we're covering a lot of ground there, but as John Margeroni in San Mateo, California says, fishing multiple flies can become a mess of tangles and frustrations. Do you have any tips regarding this problem?
As a matter of fact, Roger, I do. Biggest way to avoid clusters, tangles, is to accelerate your backcast and accelerate your forecast. If you decelerate your forecast, that's when you get the tangles. Things just kind of pile up. I fish that rig almost like I'm just throwing a dry fly. And with a little wider loop, not much wider, but a little wider loop, I get far fewer tangles fishing hopper, copper, dropper than I do fishing nymphs. Roger, do you want me to tell you about the critical way to set this up, the hopper, copper rig? Very critical. 7.5 foot, I'm going to simplify it, 7.5 foot, 3X, leader out of the package, off the fly line, and that's to your hopper. 4X, super fluorocarbon, the copper off the bend of the hopper. 4 or 5x feeder dropper. And that way, things turn over really nicely, as long as you accelerate back and forward.
Okay. Good. But good.
You can't tie the damn hopper on a 12-foot, 6x leader and expect anything really good to happen.
Yeah, you've got to have some kind of stiffness there at the beginning, right?
Yeah. I mean, you've got a nice step down from 3x to 4x, and then to either 4 or 5x, depending on the size of the fish you're catching.
Well, we also have a question here from Gary Eaton in Missouri talking about weight.
Okay.
We always hear about getting deep. I'm losing weight on the bottom in rocks and throwing it loose on casts. Is there a type of weight that sticks better without the hang-ups? And maybe you could kind of talk about this with this rig we just talked about, because I don't think you use weight on those rigs, do you?
No, I don't. On the hopper, copper, dropper, I never use any weight. My flies are pretty heavy, so I don't need split shot. When I'm nymph fishing, again, I use heavy flies, so I use very rarely do I use split shot. If I'm in a really heavy run, deeper, I'll pinch on a split shot, and what I use are just the water grip split shot with little wings on them. But the vast majority of the time, I never use split shot. And split shot can really hinge while you're casting and result in a lot of tangles. So I use my flies as a rig.
One of the questions that just came in, Jerry Crow in Hollis, New Hampshire, says, John, were there any duds in your quest to perfect the Copper John? Are there any colors or fly materials that didn't work? Your flies work great here in New England. Thanks for your creativity. It helps us catch some tough fish. So he's asking, were there any really, bad colors of the copper?
First off, thanks for the kind words. Not really. They all work.
Okay.
I fish a lot, and I know a lot of people, and some people have this color is their favorite, this color is their, total confidence color.
Mm-hmm.
I think you get a lot of just reaction strikes on the copper, because
yeah.
It really doesn't look like anything.
But,
as I said, I'm a results-oriented guy, and so I don't think there's really a bad color. I've caught trout in so many different colors.
Okay. We also, we had a question from Mike Wolf in Williamsport, Pennsylvania. He's talking about pulling fish in slower, calm waters. And since we're talking about the copper, you did mention in passing that you've used it in still water effectively. How do you fish it, Copper John, in still water? What techniques do you use?
I never fish still water without a copper. It's always my
first okay. That's confidence there.
Yeah, I'll generally fish. Yeah, I know there's regulations in different states, but here in Colorado you can fish 3 flies. So my first fly is always a copper, and that's my weight. I always fish 40 miles. So I need weight to get my flies down. And I'll fish in 2 ways. Generally it's a size 14 red copper is my first fly, because most of the midge larvae in the still waters around here are red. But red seems to be a really good go-to color. Chartreuse is good, too. My next 2 flies are flies that represent the insect activity going on at the time. That's generally damsels, calabatus, and you might throw in scuds there, too. So I'll fish a size 14 red, then I'll fish a damselfly nymph, calabatus nymph, calabatus emerger, or a midge larva. And I'll fish them either with a retrieve, slow retrieve, sometimes little pops, little tip-to-tips, pause, let them sink. I catch a lot of trout on flies that are sinking. In some situations, I'll fish indicator, throw them out, let the copper drone sink everything, and then just slowly hand twitch, stop, hand twitch, stop. That's pretty much how I fish still waters. I love
it. Okay, so give it a chance to pause and to sink a little bit is kind of a takeaway I'm getting from you there.
Oh, sink is huge.
Yeah. I mean,
all fish love flies that are dropping.
Mm.
You know, from bass to trout to a lot of saltwater fish. Instead of just a straight, you know, strip it in, retrieve, I do a lot.
Right.
Because let them sink. Let them dive.
Okay. Well, I think we've pretty much covered the Copper John. A couple closing notes on the Copper John. You have some other variations in your book. You have a rubber leg Copper John and a jumbo John. Can you kind of just briefly tell us those flies and what you've done to those and what they're used for?
Well, you know, we could spend the rest of the night talking about the variations. But they can be very effective. In fact, on the jumbo John, that's primarily for bigger fish.
Okay.
And I've used it as a trailer behind a streamer. But possibly the all-tackle brown trout, and for sure the the fly rod world record brown down in Tierra del Fuego was hooked on a jumbo John. And the net wasn't big enough, and the guide knocked it off.
Oh.
So, I mean, the jumbo John's for bigger fish.
You talk about using it for steelhead and so forth, too.
Yeah, it's a good steelhead fly.
Sure.
Okay. You know, you can't tie them all on at once.
Well, those are some variations, folks, to look for in his book, and there's many more in there as well. He's really covered the gamut with that. Let's move on to some of the general questions here, John, and see
sure.
if we can solve some of these problems for people, and then we'll come back and we'll try to talk about the Visadon and the Slump Buster as well. But I've got a question here from, again, John Margeroni in San Mateo, California. Second question he's got. I've noticed that on your emerger patterns that you trim the tail fibers to one-half the length of the hook shank rather than leaving them with a natural taper. Why is that?
Well,
or is that true?
No, it is true.
Oh, okay.
The shuck coming off an emerger isn't tapered down to a point. It generally has little gills on the end. It's kind of on the, you know, a little wider. It's not a real tapered part of the anatomy. So, it's just so much easier to tie them clipped off. And as I said, I'm a results-oriented fellow, and having caught quite a number of trout in the last 30 years on that pattern, the clipped-off version works just fine.
Okay, and it's more to simulate the actual emerger's tail than
maybe just a quick bit of background on that pattern.
Sure, go ahead.
Okay, this is 1975. I was up in Nelson Spring Creek, and every trout in the creek was rising, and there was a tremendous PMD hatch. But all we were taking were these little yellow specks. And I had no idea what was going on. So I put a nymph on and caught a trout. It happened to be a male with a great big old mouth, and he had all these partially emerged PMDs on the base of his tongue. And I said, So I went back to my motel room that night and tied that fly and went out the next day and hooked every fish that I made a good presentation. And they took it just like a natural. And these fish were pounded fish and tired of eating duns that had hooks in them. And I haven't changed the fly since. And it's been a very effective pattern just about everywhere I fish.
That's Bart, and that's the... what you call Bars Emerger?
Bars Emerger, yeah. It started off just a floating pattern, surface film pattern, and since has evolved into, subsurface and surface. A pattern you can either fish for rising fish, fish it in the surface film, or dropped off a dun pattern. And or you can fish it under an indicator as a nymph or as part of the hopper-copper-dropper combination.
Okay. And we have a question here from Steve Bourne in Madison, Wisconsin. He says, can you place your emerger design in a larger context of other emerger principles? Why did you make the design choices you made leading to your highly successful pattern? And it sounds like, if I'm correct, that you basically just copied a natural that you saw that day, right? And
you're 100% right, Rod.
Okay.
Yeah.
And so you tried to duplicate as much as you could just the natural, and you've kept it that way ever since, right?
Yeah, and at the time, I had never heard of an emerger.
Oh, okay.
Over 30 years.
It didn't exist back then, huh?
I mean, I'd never heard of an emerger. But, you know, it was a logical name for it.
Mm-hmm.
You know? And it's been, you know, money fly ever since.
Yeah, yeah, great. Let's see here. Okay, this is Ken Calhoun in Gilmer, Texas.
Okay.
He's new to fly tying. He's trying to read everything he can and collecting recipes. He finds lots of information about nymphs, dries, wet flies, streamers, and terrestrials, but little or nothing about emergers or duns. Yet I hear that emergers are, next to nymphs, some of the best flies to carry with you. So what do you consider to be the best two or three emergers to have in your box for rainbow and brown trout? Well, obviously, Barr's emerger is one of them, right?
That's the only emerger I use.
Okay, there you go.
It works.
It just works, huh?
Okay. You know, in an appropriate situation, it's going to work.
And do you tie that in different colors as well to match the hatch, so to speak?
Well, I mean, again, this we could go on forever on this, but, I mean, out here where I live, the primary mayflies are betas, PMDs, and then you get, you know, a green drake here and there and whatnot, but betas and PMDs. And so that's what I tie it, betas, you know, blue and olive. PMD version.
Yeah, yeah.
95% of the situation, but there's something about that pattern that, yeah, I mean, it's a 12-month pattern. Well, you know, you fish it all year long.
Right, right.
And fish don't get conditioned to it, which is amazing. They don't get conditioned to a lot of patterns.
Probably to explain to Ken that he's new to fly tying and so forth, that those, in general, during a hatch, the fish are taking more emergers than they are the adults on the surface. So that's why it's become such a popular fly as well, right?
Well, yeah, I mean, that's very possible. I mean, if I see fish rising, I mean, if you see every fish rising eating a dun, then I put on double visiduns. If I'm not sure what they're eating, I'll put on a visidun, which we're going to get to, with either a floater or a sunk emerger, and then I'm covering both the emerger and the adult. That's how I fish rising fish. And some fish are eating duns, some are eating emergers. You've got all your bases covered.
Okay. Let's take a 30-second break here, John, and we'll be right back.
Sounds good.
Women's fly fishing in Alaska is owned and operated by well-known female guide Pudge Kleinkopf. Women's fly fishing offers several lodge-based fly fishing schools for women, as well as an array of small group guided trips for women and couples to some of Alaska's best-known waters for salmon, rainbow trout, Arctic grayling, and char. Pudge also leads saltwater fly fishing trips to Mexico each spring. Beginners are welcome and equipment is provided. Learn more about fly fishing for women at www.womensflyfishing.net. That's women's with an E in the E-N at the end, womensflyfishing.net. Or email them at pudge@womensflyfishing.net or call at 907-274-7113. Well, you're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, and we're talking with John Barr about fly tying and fishing those great patterns John's created over the years. If you'd like to ask John a question, just go to our homepage, use that Q&A text box there to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. Well, let's see here. The other questions we have here, we've got a question from Jason Siegel and from the Roaring Fork River in Carbondale, Colorado.
Okay.
It says, you tie a great variety of midges and dedicate space in your books to these relatively easy flies to tie. If you had one midge pattern to use on the lower Roaring Fork, which I'm told you're very familiar with, from now until March, your go-to on a cold winter day, what would it be? Everybody wants that silver bullet, don't they? I said everybody wants that silver bullet fly, the one that's going to catch it.
I'll give it to them.
Okay, great.
Flashback Golden Tongue Stump.
Now, is that one in your book?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
It's a 12-month pattern. Most aquatic insects have a one-year cycle. The bigger golden stoneflies have a 2 to 3 year cycle. So there's golden stoneflies, and Roaring Fork is in the perfect stonefly river. It's loaded with golden stoneflies. And so that is always my top fly.
So it's not a midge, it's a stonefly.
As far as the midge goes, the midge larva, olive's a good color, but I would be more apt to put a small betis barb merger on, because that seems to be a great pattern when there's midge activity.
Okay.
If I was fishing three flies, I'd put flashback golden stone. Then maybe a copper and then an olive midge larva.
Okay. Got another question here from Ray Baker in Spokane, Washington.
Sure.
He wants to know where he can buy some of the fire red material to tie the pure midge larva pattern you mentioned on page 94 of your book, Barflies.
Yeah, there's shops all over the country. It's Danville 6-0 thread.
Danville 6-0, okay.
Uh-huh. And it's just, another good choice, it's not red, is Wapsie 70 Denier fluorescent orange. It'll perform about the same.
Okay. But you do like the fluorescent versions of those?
Yeah, I like the hard colors. Yeah, I like
okay. Okay. Okay, good. Okay. Sean Baker, Dallas, Texas. He also fishes in Oklahoma. I've read that some of the benefits of fishing beadhead flies is that, in addition to the weight, is that the bead often resembles the air bubbles that many insects use to breathe. Have you ever experimented with any materials to more closely mimic the air bubble on nymphs?
Roger, I don't get that scientific.
Okay. Well, that was the last part of his question. Is it worth pursuing?
No. No. It isn't. I mean, you use what works, and I have no idea what other material to use.
Yeah. Okay.
And air bubbles are, I think, pretty much overrated.
Okay.
Most nymphs don't go around with air bubbles around their face. You have air bubbles on emerging, like caddis and whatnot, but most nymphs don't have air bubbles. I think the bead serves as something to get the fly down and kind of as an attractor, maybe the reaction strikes. Obviously, they work.
Yeah. Okay, we have a couple of questions. I'm going to kind of distill these down. This is from Gert Michaels in Belgium. And because these are rather long questions, I'm going to kind of distill it down. Basically, what Gert wants to know is, what's your opinion, and have you ever heard of anybody trying to rate flies by their sink rate, like we would probably rate sinking fly lines, so many inches per second kind of thing? Is that really that critical, or is that something that you would, spend much time on or not?
I basically spend no time on it. I appreciate the question, but there's so many variables about what kind of water you're fishing, if you're fishing the rivers, how fast the current is, what kind of hook the fly is tied on, how big the fly is, how much weight you have on it, how the materials you dress the fly. Personally, all my flies that are subsurface, I tie them as heavy as I can. I put tungsten beads, tungsten cones, and lots of lead on all my flies that are just subsurface. Because getting back to an earlier comment, I use very little, rarely use split shot. So as far as sink rate, I mean, that's an impossible, unless you're doing it in an aquarium or something, you know, just kind of for academic reasons, it's a pretty much a non-factor.
Yeah, because I would think you would also have not only the current, but the, you know, any drag factors as well. Other flies, if you're doing a dropper situation, I mean, there just are a lot of variables there.
There's so many variables that that's not really anything you can, you know, quantitate. You know.
Got another question from Samuel Okoko in Kenya. Okay.
In Kenya?
You get around in Kenya. We get around the world here. I'm trying to interpret his question here. He says, do you tie your own flies or are you employed? I don't know. I'm sure that's not what he means. The way I take that is, do you have a job or do you tie flies? Like tying flies is not a job. But I think Samuel is a commercial tier there, and what he wants to know is, do you tie commercially? And
no,
if you do.
I do not tie commercially. I don't sell flies. Uncle Fed Merchants ties my patterns, and I personally don't.
You just tie for yourself.
I do not tie flies for sale. Yeah, I just tie for myself. I might give you a fly or two.
Okay. I'll take it.
But I'm not selling to you.
Yeah, yeah. I know you're priding yourself on not selling flies, so you'll have to give them to me, right?
I'm just not a, you know, production tire.
Yeah, yeah. And you're a designer, and you do design for Umpqua Feather Merchants, and a lot of your patterns are with them. I do have a question that came in here again on the internet, and it's from Stephen Lamb. He's listened to a lot of our shows, I know, down in Georgia. And he says he likes to build a lot of flies, too. He wants to know, do you have patents on your flies?
He can't really patent a fly.
Okay.
You know, someone changes thread color, it's a different fly.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
No, I don't have patents, no.
Okay. Do you want to, can you kind of explain to the tires out there if they want to work with somebody like Umpqua Feather Merchants, what they do to get a fly in there, you know, as like you have done?
I mean, there are a number of manufacturers, you know, fly manufacturers that have what they call a contract tire program, whereas you, if they decide to tie your fly, you'll get a royalty on it. And really the only advice I can give is to not knock another fly off or contrive something, come up with something, you know, truly unique that works, fish it for a few years and make sure it works, and then just send it to the companies. Like send it to Umpqua Feather Merchants. They're in Louisville, Colorado. You can just look them up on, you know, Google them, and just send your patterns to them, and they make the decisions.
Okay. All right, let's see what else we have here. Okay, Sean Baker, Dallas, Texas again. A while ago, you shared your different fly box setups with Fly Fisherman Magazine, and I think you also have that in your book, right? Pictures of those fly boxes?
Yeah, they are.
Yeah, yeah, those are beautiful.
Thank you.
Ever lose one of those, John?
Do you think my fly boxes have ever looked like that after about 5 minutes on the river?
Okay. I just want to know if you were that of much of a neat freak, you know?
No, my flies are in there backwards and sideways.
Okay. Now, this was just a studio shot here, Sean. He really doesn't fish that way. But he wants to know, have you made any significant changes to the contents as to what you keep in there, or is it pretty much...
Not really. It's about the same as what you see in the pictures.
Okay. All those confidence patterns, right?
Those are my confidence patterns, yeah. I mean, you know, Roger, I mean, there are lots of good patterns for a given situation. Going back to emergers, lots of good emergers, lots of good patterns for, you know, for what you're doing, but you've got to, you can't carry, you know, a million patterns, so you've got to just get your confidence patterns, and if the situation is right, have an appropriate pattern, and if conditions are good and if you have good presentation, that pattern will work. But there's a number of patterns that will work for a given situation. Those are just my confidence patterns.
Yeah, yeah. Here's a question that came in on the Internet while we were talking, and it goes back to the hopper-dropper situation.
Okay.
So he's avoided using a dry fly indicator or hopper for fishing nymphs because of having to change this fly very often. It gets waterlogged after catching fish on one of the nymphs. What's the solution? Foam hoppers or indicator flies?
Easy solution to that. The BC hopper. It's the most buoyant, high-riding hopper on Earth. And the BC hopper was a pattern that, again, and that's in the book, and tie instructions and everything. But I'll generally get about 3 hours out of a BC hopper.
Okay.
Closed cell foam is, it gets waterlogged. And, but, I mean, that's the most buoyant of all the dry flies. I'll say you get about 3 hours, but a real key thing, a lot of people don't realize, they think this closed cell foam floats forever, but you need to cover it with silicone dry fly floatant. I cover the whole hopper with, you know, with dry fly floatant, all the dressing on the hopper, as well as especially the foam. And that's how you can get it to last longer.
Okay, and closed cell foam, and then now, do you actually just rub it on, or do you soak it, or?
No, I just rub it on with my fingers.
Okay, okay. All right. Let's see what other questions we've had come in here. Okay, this is Kevin Kritzer in Jackson, Wyoming. Could you discuss whether you have any preferences when it comes to fishing your flies below strike indicators, for example, styrofoam, fabric threads, and other flies, and how far do you determine? How far down do you go with those? Sounds like you use primarily a fly as your indicator, but do you use indicators?
No, I nymph fish as well, yeah. And the indicator I like is just a little round styrofoam ball made by Strike King, and I put my leader through and then back through again, and it's real easy to adjust. I don't like yarn indicators. And because there's, you know, I'm not going to use a hopper for an indicator, you know, at times, especially when I'm fishing like heavier, deeper water or anything to really get down there. And, I mean, you hear all kinds of things, you know, 1.5 times depth of water. But, I mean, you don't fish the same depth of water all the time. And as I said earlier, fish will come up for flies. So I generally try to adjust my indicator about the distance from the surface bottom of the river.
Yeah, I guess it kind of depends on how you're using an indicator, whether you're using it as an indicator or whether you're using it as a suspension device, right? And there can be a difference in that.
Well, a suspension device like in a lake?
Well, yeah. I mean, if you're trying to maintain a depth in say, some deeper water or something, as opposed to fishing shallower water where you're really not suspending the fly. It's drifting its own natural drift, and you're just using an indicator as an indicator.
I mean, it's such an inexact science how far you put the flies below the indicator.
Right.
I just try to pretty much match the depth of the water I'm fishing.
Yeah.
If it's deeper, I'll raise my indicator. If it's shallower, I'll lower my indicator. You know,
okay. Let's take another 30-second break here, John, and we'll be right back.
Okay.
Pere Marquette River Lodge, a full-service Orvis-endorsed lodge, fly shop, and guide service located on the banks of the historic Pere Marquette River in Baldwin, Michigan, providing year-round lodging for business or pleasure traveler, as well as a full-service fly shop and guided trips for steelhead, salmon, or large resident brown trout. For more information, visit us at www.pmlodge.com or call 231-745-3972. That's 231-745-3972. We hope to see you soon. Well, you're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, and we're talking with John Barr about fly tying and fishing, fishing his flies. If you'd like to ask him a question, type it in on our homepage in that Q&A text box, and we'll get it immediately, and we'll try to answer it here on the show tonight. Okay, now, John, I want to try to hit a couple of these other flies here quickly. Maybe not as thoroughly as we did with the Papa John, but there's a couple others out there that you're well known for. One is called the Visidun. You want to tell us how this came about, and then we'll take a look at tying that one as well.
Okay, I'll try to make this brief. It's a fly, really, I started tying, again, back in the 70s. And back then I called it the Bulletproof Dun. And what you don't see looking at the fly is that it's pretty much glued together. So small dry flies tied with hackle are pretty fragile. The hackle stem is very thin. It can break pretty easily, especially if you're hooking browns that have teeth. And so what I did was I tied this fly with glue on the wing. The wing is kind of spread out like a Caparadun style. And so that keeps the wing, the shape of the wing, very good for till you lose the damn fly, really. And then also after I wrap the hackle, I will clip it on the bottom and put head cement right into the hackle stems so it impregnates it into the dubbing and makes a very durable small fly, and it's just a very, very effective small dry fly when you have a mayfly hatch. And I also use it as an indicator if I'm fishing a fly that I can't see very well, like an ant or a beetle, with a webwing caddis, which sometimes it's hard to pick up. And the really key thing here, trico spinner falls, always tough. Fish the black body Visidun, which the trout will take about a quarter of the time, because I think at the right angle, and floating right on the surface, will take it as a spinner. But I'll fish almost all the time with drown spinner behind the black body Visidun and use the Visidun to tell me if I'm getting a totally dry creek drift, which you want with a spinner, it's the third dip, and acts as an indicator if they take that drown spinner.
Okay. So the key, and again, folks, if you joined us a little later, you can see this pattern by going to John's speaker page on our site, which you can get to on our homepage in his section where it says More About John Barr. Click on that. Go to his speaker page. Scroll down. You'll see the name down there, Visidun, and to the right fly recipe. Click on that. It'll take you to Charlie Craven's website, where he's a great recipe there and photographs of this Visidun. So this is a great all-around mayfly imitation, and I notice you tie this again in appropriate colors, depending on the hatch as well.
Yeah,
and like I said, just changing out body color more than anything else, it seems.
Yeah, you're exactly right, Roger.
Okay. Okay. Body. Good. And durable, that's the thing, so you don't have to change it up like we were talking about the hoppers before, too. Sounds like you're into durability. You don't like changing flies either.
Especially small dries, they're very fragile, you know, but this thing is just, you know, it's nails.
Yeah. Great. Well, that's some techniques you can use, too. I think when you spread the wing, that's when I was looking at your book, that the poly yarn that you use for the wing, you kind of spread in a fan effect, right? And then you put some glue at the base of that to hold it in that fan position.
Exactly.
Is that
correct?
Okay.
That wing maintains its shape really nice, really nicely.
Yeah.
Incredibly visible patterns, much more visible than like a parachute atoms in small sizes, 20s, 22s, whatnot. It's very, very visible. He's a real light gray polypropylene for the wing.
And it looks like it's easy to tie in the way that you've done it, too, here. It doesn't look that difficult.
No, it's not bad.
Yeah. Let me see if I got any questions coming in here. Oh, well, this is a little bit different. Rod Brash here is in Amarillo again. Wants to know how many hours you spend tying a week and what type of vise you tie on.
I tie on a Dynaking Pro. I have been for years. And I can tie anything from a 24 to a 8-aught Mako shark fly. And never had a problem with vice. And how many hours? Oh, it varies. The season. I have no idea how many hours I spend a week.
Just when you need flies to go fishing, right?
I tie for need, exactly.
Yeah, yeah. This is another interesting question. Sean Baker in Dallas, Texas says, thanks for all your work with the flies. Would you point to any particular tire as someone you admire most or as being most influential? Or would you say that just observation and tying from specimens has been your biggest influence?
Well, I mean, let me just say a couple things on that. I don't consciously design flies. They just kind of come to me, for whatever reason. While I'm out in the water, whatever. The best fly tying instructor I've ever been around is Charlie Craven, who took the photos for my book. So as far as most influential, as far as patterns, no one comes to mind, but Charlie's the best fly tier I've ever seen.
He sure is good, and he sure knows how to take the photographs, too. You've got to at least look at John's book to just, and look at the photographs that are in there to appreciate it. It's I think, the best I've ever seen in the way of fly tying instruction of flies. I don't know how you could get any better. Do you, John?
Well, it's funny you say that because I was just talking to Bob Story at Feathercraft today, and they've been around forever. And he said the best photos he's ever seen in the book, best fly tying photos he's ever seen.
And he's seen a lot. He's seen a lot.
He's seen them all.
Yeah, yeah, in his catalogs and so forth. So.
And, we're just kind of glossing over things here, and the book Barflies has every one of these patterns and has a lot of layman's etymology in it and a lot of technique and as far as, fishing the patterns and how and when
right.
and where, everything. So, we're just kind of clipping the tops here, Buck.
Yeah, yeah. Well, let's dig in a little bit deeper on the slump buster, which is a totally different kind of fly. We're covering like three different flies here tonight.
Yeah.
And again, that pattern is on John Speaker's page, so if you'd like to take a look at it while we're talking about it. And again, why don't you give us a little background on the slump buster?
Well, I'll tell you, I get Wapsie from Mountain Home, Arkansas. They send me a lot of new stuff they get in, new materials. Joe Schmucker sent me this Zocker stripped pine squirrel skin, and I looked at it, and I said, that's really cool. So the slump buster just immediately came into my mind. And what's cool about that fly, other than the fact that it really is effective, catches fish, but it's a one-piece construction. The tail is the tip of the pine squirrel strip. The wing, like Zonker style wing, is part of the same strip. And then the collar is the rest of the strip. And then it's got a cone, tungsten or brass, we use tungsten. And you put super glue in that cone and jam it up into that collar. So you've got just a very, very durable fly. And the underbody is sparkle grade with ultra wire holding down the rabbit strip on top of the shank. And I tie that on 52-63 Tamco hook. And it's just a, killer pattern.
It looks like, I'm looking at your instructions here, when you start tying in the squirrel, you tie it at the back?
Yeah.
And then do you just then tie it back in at the front? You don't weave through it or anything? It doesn't.
I tie it in right behind the cone, and then I rib it with ultra wire.
Okay,
so
okay.
It locks it down to the body.
Okay. And then you just continue with that, wrapping it around as a collar? You don't?
Exactly.
It's all the same piece, right?
Yep.
So you just have to cut it properly to the proper length to start with, and then you're all set to go.
Well, I just start off with the full length piece, and then what's ever left over, if I have enough to tie another fly, I'll use it. If I don't, that strip's done with it.
Well, I assume by the name Slump Buster that this is got to be an effective fly because it sounds like this is one you go to when you're in a slump, right?
You're absolutely right, Roger.
Pretty obvious, huh?
You put on a slump buster.
Yeah, yeah. Now, you've done this in a couple. I'm going to ask you about colors again because I think you did comment on some colors here in your commentary about this. You want to tell us about that?
Yeah, I tie it in four colors, the natural pine squirrel, the black, olive, and rust. And generally, I fish a size 4 natural for my first fly, and then off the bend of that, I'll put a rust. That's my go-to combination. But I can change that second fly out to a black or an olive, just depending on whatever. And I tied both flies on to OX tippet. That's as light a tippet as I ever fished streamers on, is OX. And I use high-grade fluorocarbon, Rio Fluoroflex Plus or Umco Super Fluorocarbon to both flies. And a lot of anglers will just cast their flies to the bank, the strip. But I'll throw mine out in the middle of the river, just let them drift, maybe swit, just twitch, then let them dive. And I've got an awful lot of fishes that flies diving. And a lot of people don't do that, but it's a very effective approach.
Interesting question here came in. Let's see here. Huh. Dave in Boulder. This must be one of your neighbors up there, John.
Is this a planted question, do you think?
I don't know. Dave in Boulder. I don't get the impression that you purposely went out to heavily promote the Copper John. Was there a particular person, shop, or company that helped your Copper John become the commercial success that it is? That's a great question.
That is a good question, Dave. I actually don't do any self-promotion whatsoever. I don't do programs or time demos or anything. I think the fly promoted itself. You know, if something works, it promotes itself. You don't have to go out and hype it.
So it was more word of mouth on the river, you think, than anything else? Just friend to friend?
Oh, absolutely.
Wow.
I'm not on the lecture trail or anything. People got results from it and talked about it, and word got around, and that's kind of how it transpired.
Yeah, yeah. Great, great. Let's see what else we got here. Oh. And this was one of the first questions that came in. I've been saving it. But Sean Hansen in Milwaukee, Wisconsin says, what do you consider the ideal conditions for fishing your slump buster? And what color and size do you feel most productive? I think you addressed that already. But what about conditions?
You know, you can fish it really under any conditions, and it can be effective. When I most like to throw streamers is if the weather's bad. It's overcast, it's blowing, it's raining, that sort of thing. But I've caught plenty of fish on slump busters, on a nice bluebird, beautiful day. So I don't know if there's a bad time to throw it if you're in the mood to throw streamers.
Right. Just deciding that to make that change and work a different system there. Yeah. Well, we've had, a couple of... looks like beginning fly fishers out there.
Okay.
One had asked about, talks about learning from videotapes, and that's the way he learns best rather than from watching demos or something because he can replay them over and over. Are there any demos that you have on tape on fly tying or ones that you can recommend for a learning process?
As far as tying flies?
Yeah, yeah.
No.
Okay. Okay. Well, there's a lot of them out there. I'd suggest just go to, Feathercraft is one place I know that has a lot of DVDs and so forth that you can get. So.
I really think that, my book with the step ties, Charlie Craven's tutorials and photos, you can learn how to tie flies better than any video.
Yeah, yeah.
He shows all angles, you know, every little minute step.
Yeah, yeah, it's very detailed, I have to say that, yeah.
Much more valuable way to learn tie flies in video.
Yeah, and that's a good comment. Okay, we need to finish up here. We're running out of time.
Okay.
But stick with me, John, here till the end, and we're going to give away your book here in a little bit, ask a question, and see if somebody can come up with the right answer. Have you ever dreamed about classic actions of bamboo fly rods? Do you know that it's possible for you to make your own bamboo fly rods? With the help of Power Fibers online magazine, you can do just that. Power Fibers is a magazine dedicated to making bamboo fly rods and telling the stories about bamboo through the ages. From rod making techniques to stories about fishing bamboo rods to rod maker profiles to classic tapers, Power Fibers has it all. Visit our website at www.powerfibers.com. That's www.powerfibers.com for more information. Well, from our global events calendar, we see that starting in December 8th from 9 a.m. to 4 p.m., the annual Metalhead Christmas Party and annual Winter Steelhead Clinic is taking place at the Fly Fishing Shop in Welch's, Oregon. Come meet the company reps from TFO, Teeny, Sage, Sims, Rio, Ross, Tibor, Winston, Patagonia, Echo, Airflora, and G. Loomis. And there will be guides and instructors providing demonstrations, fly tying, casting, and slideshows on steelhead and saltwater fishing. Also, don't miss the barbecue that's being served from 11:30 to 1. If you want to find out more about this event, go to our global events calendar. You'll find a link at the bottom of each of our pages on our website. And go to that, click on U.S., then go to Oregon, and you'll see that event there, and you can click through to their website and get more information. So if you'd like to put an event on our site, feel free to do so. If you're a fly shop, club, list all your events on our global events calendar for free. You can do it yourself, and we announce one of those events every week on our show. So keep that in mind. Well, just a quick reminder to everyone before you leave the website tonight, please take a minute and give us your feedback about the show. You can find a link on our homepage in the section for tonight's show that says, "What did you think of this show?" Just click on that link, leave your comments. We'd really appreciate it. Well, now it's time to give away a few things. So let me bring up my magic button here. Now, to win our two drawings, and the first drawing will be for a membership, 3-year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers, and then we'll do a 1-year subscription to Fly Fusion Magazine. To qualify for these, you have to fill out our registration form, which I had mentioned at the beginning of the show. It's a little late to do that now, but keep that in mind for the next show because we're always giving us some great prizes. So for the 3-year membership to Federation of Fly Fishers, let me go out and press my magic button. We'll see what we get here. And we've got Marilyn Shepherd in New Jersey. Marilyn Shepherd in New Jersey. Congratulations, Marilyn. You'll enjoy that 3-year membership. It's a great organization to support, too, as well. Okay, so our second winner will be for the 1-year subscription to Fly Fusion Magazine. And that is going to be John Matthews in Colorado. John Matthews in Colorado. And if you're not familiar with Fly Fusion Magazine, it's a magazine out of Calgary, Canada, and great magazine with great photography again, which we all appreciate. So congratulations, John. All right. Last gift to give away, which is a great gift, is a copy of John's book, Barflies. So if you don't have this, you're going to want to get ready to answer this question. And I'll give you a second. Get to our homepage. See that text box in the middle of the page there, just below John's section. And you want to put in your name and your location. Got to have that. Otherwise, you won't qualify here. And answer this question, and John will determine whether the answer is correct or not. So, John, here's the question I'm going to pose to him. At the beginning of the show, we talked about the copper John, and the original color was natural copper, and we were looking for that magic fly, the best one, the go-to fly, but you said it was really a tie in colors, and the other color, other than copper, was what? What was that color? And first one with their name and location and the proper color will win John's book.
You're not asking me for an answer?
No, I'm not asking you. I know you know the answer. I'm waiting for them to type it in now. I'm sitting here at my computer, John, and I'm waiting for somebody to give me the right answer here. So.
Okay.
Ah, we got one here. I think he's got it right. Jerry Crow, and his answer is red. Is that right, John?
That is 100% right.
Well, that's the first person that came through had the correct answer.
Well, it's
quick. And, Jerry, I see you've put your email address in here. That's great. That's what I'll need. I'll email you for your mailing information, and you'll be getting that book directly from Stackpole Books, which is the publisher that John works with. And congratulations. That's a great prize, right, John?
Absolutely. Enjoy, Jerry.
Yeah, great. All right. That's about it. Well, John, hey, thanks for being on the show tonight. I appreciate it. We surely enjoy talking to you about your different flies. And I know I just want to mention we did at the beginning of the show that you are coming out with that other DVD on fishing for bass. So maybe when that comes out, we can invite you back and we can talk about warm water bass fishing. Would you be up for something like that?
Oh, yeah. I love to bass fish. I bass fish a bunch every year. Landon Mayer and I did that this year, and both in Colorado and Texas. And, it really came out good. I just saw it for the first time last Sunday. And
so you're getting close with it, huh?
No, it's at the duplicator now.
We're getting real close. Well, good. Well, congratulations on that. We'll look forward to seeing that out on the market. Good. Well, our next broadcast will be on December 19th at 7 p.m. Mountain Time, 9 p.m. Eastern Time. And in that show, we're going to have Eric Patin. And our topic on the show will be effective nymphing and techniques for streams and rivers. Eric started his fly fishing long before strike indicators entered the scene and developed his techniques based upon close attention to the habits of trout. Eric will share his secrets and detail his shallow, medium depth, and deep water techniques, including leader, tippet, weight, and fly selection. So join us for that show. It's going to be a good one. We'd like to thank ISE, the International Sportsman's Expositions, AFTA, the American Fly Fishing Trade Association, Women's Fly Fishing, Pere Marquette River Lodge, and Power Fibers Online Magazine for sponsoring our show tonight. Don't forget to visit our website at askaboutflyfishing.com and make sure you signed up to receive our announcements so you don't miss out on any of our future broadcasts. Thanks for listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio. We hope you enjoyed the show. That's it. Good night, everyone, and good fishing.